Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the forthcoming novel Brotherless Night.
Okay, as listeners to our podcast know, at least this summer, I'm in Lyon, France. I'm here because my wife, Gail Levy, is leading a student abroad program here for students at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and actually students from universities all over the country.
And you basically come along for the ride. You are a lucky man.
I am a lucky man. But the fact that Gail routinely runs this student abroad program, which incidentally focuses on the resistance to the Nazis during World War II, which was très, très fort here in Lyon, which means that we spent like six or seven summers here over the course of our children's lives over the past 16 years.
I'm crying a single tear for you, Whitney. This does not make you less lucky.
No. I love this city. It's an amazing, amazing opportunity that public education in Missouri has afforded us and afforded many other students who've come here with Gail and her colleagues who teach them here about the resistance to the Germans during World War II. There's nothing bad about this, you know. But it means I spent a lot of time here. I was here when I first went to Iraq. I left from Lyon. I watched our sons grow up here and then, you know, playing around in the Parc de la Tête d'Or and all along the Rhône and along the Saône and on the Rue de la République and all these great places in Lyon.
So what you're saying is it's better than Kansas City. That's what you're saying. That's what you're saying. Everyone heard that. It's on the podcast record. It's going out to thousands of listeners.
Here's what I'm going to say about Kansas City and Lyon. They're roughly the same size. But if you measure a city's worth by rivers, and I do, Kansas City does have the confluence of the Missouri and Kansas rivers, but Lyon is built on the confluence of the Rhône and the Saône, so that's a toughie. That's tough to beat. And if you give points for wine quality, then you're really, you know, it's the Rhône Valley, not the Missouri River Valley. What are your connections to France, Sugi, if any?
And I should say, points for wine quality. That's the only kind of points I plan to give out for anything this summer. My connections to France. I am related to scads of French people.
Mentioning these imaginary French people that you're related to. They're like your childhood friends.
My French cousins.
My French cousins that I imagine I'm friends with.
My French cousins and my French uncle and there are a lot of them. And I think that the part of Paris that is particularly of interest to me, because it is basically Little Jaffna, is actually outside of Gare du Nord. And I love like the kind of fusion of French and Thummel food is amazing. And I just have had a really good time every time I visited, and specifically because of the hospitality of my family there, which they live not only in Paris, but in other parts of the country as well. So I've had the opportunity to travel a little. It's not six or seven summers studying the resistance, but you know, we do what we can. But you're the expert here. So you lay the groundwork for this episode. Tell our listeners why we're talking France.
Yes, we're going to do an episode about politics in France and what's going on in France politically, which is very interesting. And you know, France has been an important country for the United States, as you'll hear us discuss during this podcast, you know, since the time of the Marquis de Lafayette and even before then, you know, and with Britain's exit from the EU and the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, the politics in France are even more important and relevant than ever. So while I'm here, I thought we should at least take a moment to talk about what is happening in this country and how it relates to us and how it relates to world events.
To do that, we're going to talk to Diane Louis and Benjamin Guérif. Diane Louis was born in Newfoundland and grew up in Connecticut. She earned degrees from Oberlin College and the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop for both fiction and poetry. Her work has appeared in Epoch, Arts and Letters, Field, Tri-Quarterly, Cloudbank, and elsewhere. Her book of prose poems, Fractal Shores, is a winner of the National Poetry Series and the 2021 John Pollard Foundation International Poetry Prize. She lives in Paris with her partner, a research scientist.
And Benjamin Guérif is an editor at Les Éditions Gallmeister, a publishing house founded by Oliver Gallmeister that specializes in French translations of American writers. Benjamin oversees the Totem Collection, or imprint, at Gallmeister, which specializes in translations of American nature writing. He is also the author of the novel Pietro Chiarini and four novels in the collection Rat Noir, which he co-wrote with his brother. His father, François Guérif, was the French editor for my first novel, Le Chasseur Solitaire, and they both helped publish The Good Lieutenant at Gallmeister, so I owe a lot to the Guérif family, père et fils. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thanks, Whitney. Hello. Hello to everybody. I'm happy to be there with you.
Welcome, both of you, to the show. And just to set things up for our American listeners, and I have to apologize to all of our French-speaking listeners for my own pronunciation, which I'm going to do my best on, but Whitney is the champion of this, not me. Back in April of this year, French President Emmanuel Macron won re-election with 58.5% of the vote, defeating far-right candidate Marine Le Pen in a runoff election. And this was seen as a big victory from Macron. But just a few weeks ago, France held a parliamentary election, and those results were much more mixed. And Macron's candidates from the Ensemble Party won 245 seats, which is short of the 289 seats needed for a majority. And two other parties made important gains in that election. One was a left-wing coalition, Nouvelle Union Populaire Écologique et Sociale, organized by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, which won 131 seats. And the other was Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party, which won a record 89 seats. Oh my God.
So we have three dominant figures right now in France, in politics, as far as I understand it, and our guests may correct me if they disagree. On the left, Mélenchon, and the center, Macron, and on the right, Le Pen. Could we just talk a little bit about who each of these candidates are for our American audience and what they want to do politically? What are their platforms and goals? Benjamin, maybe you could give us an overview on Macron.
Alors, first, I will remind something that you probably know. Is some important words in the political fields seem to be the same in English, American English, and French, but it's not true. They don't have the same meaning. For example, Macron is un libéral. He is in France. But it means that he believes in a lighter state. He wants an entrepreneurial economy as free as possible, low taxes, free international trade, and so on. A kind of, Reaganomics, but less brutal.
The unfortunate thing is, Benjamin, is that that's what the liberals in America want too. They've stopped being liberal.
But they don't pretend to be Reagan's heirs.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, just a kind of Reaganomics, but with more social protection, mm-hmm. A mix. They are centrist, in fact. They are not a style to, multiculturalism or minorities' rights, the French liberal, but it's not so important for them, too. I mean, they are not like American progressist on the social field. The words don't have exactly the same meaning. The French and European political scene is not, or not yet perhaps, divided between liberal, and conservative, like between Democrats and Republicans. Macron presents itself as a centrist, which is true, absolutely true, and a moderate, which is perhaps not so true. He saw once that against l'extrême droite, far right, and l'extrême gauche, far left, or leftist, or whatever, he was d'extrême centre, the far center. So it means it's an old proverb, of the French tradition. Je ne suis pas je suis républicain modéré, mais pas modérément républicain. It means I am a moderate Republican against, you know, the King's party, but I am not modérément républicain.
Yeah, I'm not moderately a Republican. Basically.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think Macron is like that. He is in the center. That's true. He's liberal for European ones. He is not necessarily moderate. Not necessarily.
Okay. Benjamin, I so appreciate that assessment of terms, because I think, yeah, we're tossing around language that we normally use on this podcast, but really in a different direction. So I have to ask about Mélenchon. My French friends are generally left-leaning and would clearly vote Democrat in the U.S. They also think that the Democrats in the U.S. are appallingly center, and they have very mixed opinions of Mélenchon. And some say he's good because he's a genuine socialist and cares about working class people in kind of the Bernie Sanders style. And other folks say that Mélenchon is a populist, that he has a too favorable opinion of, for example, Putin, and that he's anti-immigrant and anti-EU, which they don't like. And so, Diane, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Mélenchon's role as a leader of the French left.
Sure. In that question, I think the operative word may be a leader rather than the leader. And that although Mélenchon is attempting to be to consolidate his position as the leader. Like any agile politician, Mélenchon's stated positions have evolved to reflect the concerns and maintain support of multiple constituencies over time. And in any case, at this point, he's effectively the strongest voice in the fragmented left. Any one of you will correct me at any point. He calls himself a political activist, and in that role, he appears to have five objectives: to be the spokesperson for a coalition of different, sometimes competing parties, the socialists, greens, or environmentalists, communists. He's returning the left to the playing field, making the party a major political player again. He's articulating a vision or a plan with policies and strategies to keep these concerns in the current public discourse. He's working as a counterbalance to Macron's tendency to move to the right. And he's creating an electoral power that can win elections. That's his goal. The coalition, NUPES, is the youngest political force on the left. But with Mélenchon's leadership, it's also at this point the largest and the most organized. In the age group 25 to 35, Mélenchon enjoys huge support, and which I especially appreciated when talking with a young friend who is 29 years old, who respects Mélenchon's efforts and policies, for example, prioritizing public service, incentivizing climate-friendly development in public and private sectors. But this is not blanket support. For example, he says he's on the fence about Mélenchon's position in Europe. I mean, position on Europe, not in Europe, position on Europe.
And then doesn't he want to leave the EU? Isn't that one of his things? Doesn't Mélenchon want to leave the EU?
I think that's shifted. I mean, my sense is all of that is yes and no. Okay. I mean, he's a political beast, right?
Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
In contrast, I spoke with friends who are much older of my generation, and one who noted how Mélenchon has moved from being a moderate under President Mitterrand to his present what this friend called radicalization, and another friend who compared Mélenchon to Mussolini and Castro. So you can see there are multiple views of this man, and I think fairly.
So, of course, this leaves Marine Le Pen, and the Le Pen family has been trying to push French politics to the right for a long time. Can we talk a little bit about, Benjamin, maybe you can take this question, what Marine Le Pen wants and what that recent success in the parliamentary elections means for France?
It's difficult to know what Marine Le Pen wants exactly. It's very difficult to know. For decades, the National Rally, Front National, has been nationalist, very liberal on economic field, economic topics, Reaganian, Thatcherians, and very conservative on the social questions. So no gay marriage, no social security for immigrants, no multiculturalism, more police forces, this kind of program. So, but that was the old Front National, who was created and ruled for 30 years by Marine's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is now more than 80 years old and quite silent. Marine Le Pen changed the official political lines of the party. She pretends now to protect workers, blue collars, against international finance, against free trade, against excesses of capitalism. Nowadays, she defends important social measures, but she's still nationalist. She wants, you know, closed borders, well-guarded. She doesn't like Islam. She considers France was better 50 years ago, which is absolutely not true. She thinks immigration from Africa is the main problem of France. But does she really want to rule the country? She succeeded in de-diaboliser, you mean normalize the party. No more moderate in its nationalism. But many people think that a party born in the far right, close to the fascist tradition, will always stay somewhere a bit fascist. And other people think, but when Front National has been created, it was 1%. It was only 30 years after the occupation, and it was 1% of the votes. And now we are 80 years after the war, and Marine Le Pen had 44% of the votes in the last presidential election, which is the most important in France. So it's not fascist anymore. It's over. It's old story. And both of them, these people, can, both of the opinion are understandable. If you were born close to the fascist tradition, you know, fascist one day, fascist forever. Mm-hmm. And other people say, no, it's not the same context, it's not the same thing, it's different. No, you know, she's a nationalist and socialist, national and socialist.
I mean, there are some people that said that Trump, when he started off, was showing socialist tendencies, that he was willing to do things that Republicans didn't previously do in terms of helping out unions and stuff like that.
Trump changed a very important topic in the Republican Party. The party was Thatcherian. He was for the free trade, for the individual success, for the low taxes, for all of that. And after Trump, it was like, you know, I'm your champion, you blue collars, you poor, you America with difficulties or things like that. And I think everywhere in the Western world, in the right side, a bit radical right, you have this meeting between social preoccupations and nationalism. I think that. And perhaps I'm wrong. Yeah. But
well, speaking of fascism and the war, I want to talk a little bit about how the war in Ukraine. I just had dinner this evening with two Ukrainian refugees who are living here in France, who looked, it was heartbreaking. I mean, there's this 14-year-old girl and her mom, their dad, who is a PhD student. They're from Odessa. He is like fighting in the war right now. He's like a 40-year-old man, you know. And I've been to war, and I know what it's like, and it's, you know, I can't imagine how frightened they must be. So, in Lyon, one of the interesting things is, where I am right now, there are markers all over the city. This is a spot that was very strong for the resistance against the Germans during the Second World War. And there are little markers for saying, so-and-so was killed here by the Germans, or so-and-so was shot here by the Germans resisting the occupation. And there's a civic commitment to remembering how terrible things were under the occupation, which is something that the U.S. post-revolution has never experienced. What is it like for you as French citizens to watch the citizens of Ukraine undergo this? I mean, I'm sorry, you as a French citizen, Benjamin, and you, Diane, as an American in France, to watch Ukraine, the citizens of Ukraine, undergo a similar occupation. It is so similar to what happened to the French during the Second World War. And how do the French and these varying French politicians view their role in the war there? How do people think Macron has handled it? Diane, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, first, clearly there's support. When the French object to something, they make it known in the streets, and there have been no anti-war protests. I mean, just support for Ukraine, opposition to Russian aggression was not a major campaign issue. Polls show that overall the French appear to support Macron's handling of the crisis and to appreciate, certainly to appreciate Europe as a united force. The importance of that. About Macron and his role, it's important to remember that Macron was trying to broker peace as the rotating president of the European Union, as well as the president of France. And was he bound to fail? Macron, who's had a dialogue with Putin for many years, has been critical of the French, of the foreign affairs ministry, saying that they were too wary when dealing with Putin. And now we see who read Putin more astutely, right? The foreign affairs ministry obviously understood this guy's character all along. And to Macron's credit, he's trying to keep communication with Russia open, I suppose, while fully supporting Ukraine. And this support
But is that to his credit? I just want to ask this question, maybe of you and Benjamin. So I listen to Ukrainian podcasts by Ukrainian journalists who are in Ukraine. They are furious at Macron for talking
to him. Yes, they are. They are.
By the way, we're going to use the American pronunciation of Putin. We're not going to say Poutine, which is what the French say. And Putin is a bad word in French. Too bad. We're talking to an American audience. This is no one would understand if we said Poutine.
Right.
But
right.
So the Ukrainians are furious at Macron for constantly talking to Putin.
Right.
Do the French care? Or they think it's a good idea for him to be doing this?
Well, I think that one thing that's happened is that Macron himself has emphasized France's support when he went to Kiev with the leaders of Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands, where the four leaders confirmed their support of Ukraine's eventual integration into the EU. So that's Macron. I personally think I think he's been played, and I think he's naive, and I think he's arrogant, all those things. But I think it's wonderful what he's trying to do, because what else in this world, what else can you do? What else can you do? You have to try.
If Putin won't listen, even if he's sick and dies soon, you have to try, of course. So it was not absolutely brilliant, but he tried. I agree with you. Honestly, Russian medias, which are very, dominated by the Kremlin, they say they created a word in Russian. It's to Macron. It means to talk small talks. You know, it's to talk uselessly. I don't know if it's true. I don't speak Russian, but whatever.
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say one thing.
Yeah.
Perhaps people don't know. Europe for centuries has been ruled by a pentarchy, five countries. Sometimes one change being replaced by another, and if you look like Europe now, England is out, European Union. Austria disappeared as a great power. Germany has no army. Stay Russia and France. It's not comfortable for us, you know. It's not at all comfortable. But you just have to talk, you know. No choice.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered real quickly if you could, are the other candidates, the other groups that we talked about at the beginning, Mélenchon, the far left or the far right with Le Pen, do they have differing opinions on how this should be handled? Are they making arguments or criticizing Macron, or are they all united and say that Ukraine should be supported by France?
Everybody will be trying to crush Macron, of course. Okay. After that, far right and far left has in common a kind of hate of liberalism in the French acceptation of the word.
Doesn't Mélenchon kind of like Putin a little bit? Doesn't he? We talked about this
Mélenchon,
earlier.
Mélenchon is not anti-immigration. I heard that, but in fact, Mélenchon used very much the African population. And is a Muslim. Islam, yeah.
Well, I got that wrong. That was my fault.
No, I'm not sure it's very sincere, you know. Say, you are oppressed. You are the poor people in France. It's because France is awful. So vote for me. It's this kind of discourse, you know. Yeah. I think the most important common point between Mélenchon and Le Pen is they hate the individual freedom, except if for the leftist sexual questions, you know, sexual or things like that. And for the right, if it's to be a kind of anarchist, who could say, I don't care you, go off, disappear. I don't want to talk with you. This kind of discourse. They don't like what is the basis of democracy, which is the discussion and the compromise. They don't like the compromise. For both of them, to compromise, to find a compromise is weakness. That's what I think, because of course I'm a centrist. So perhaps I'm wrong, you know, but it's what I feel. And I read some days ago in an American renowned paper, the problem in the States is that we don't have any more centrists. I don't know if it's true. It was the opinion of the journalist. But I understand this argumentation. You know, I understand that. We should be able to build compromises with others. We should accept to not have all the truth just for us. We are not a church, you know. You can be a leftist, a centrist, or from the far right. It's difficult for me, the far right, but
we're going to stick with French politics because that's going to be an idea that's very hard to convince Americans of. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I think, it's interesting to hear you talk about the ways in which different French political leaders are, I mean, of course, manipulating issues to their own ends. And of course, in the United States, we see Republicans kind of, and others, I mean, I think sort of piling on Biden, problems that are not of his making are being laid at his feet. We've talked a little bit about that on this show. And I'm curious, here in the U.S., one of those problems is, of course, the economy. And I'm curious about how the French economy is affecting voters. Whitney has been sending me photos of posters put up by, and wait, I'm sure
Gilets
I'm saying
Jaune.
This wrong, the Gilets Jaunes. That was what I was going to say, in fact. they are a grassroots movement that sprang up in 2017 and 2018 in opposition to Macron's tax policy, specifically a tax increase on diesel and petrol, which would be used to fund green energy. And so right now in the U.S., everyone here is very upset about fuel prices and generally inflation. And is that still an issue in France? How are people talking about the French economy in relation to these voting decisions?
I do I respond, or it's mm-hmm. Diane?
No, you do.
I do. Okay. Oh yes, le pouvoir d'achat. I don't know the word in American. Purchasing
power.
Power.
Purchasing
spending,
power.
Spending. Well, okay. Has been the most important question in the elections. In fact, a part of the society is poor, and many people are afraid to become poor. Many more people mm-hmm. are afraid mm-hmm. to become poor. So this question of will I, shall I become poor? It's partly true because many people don't have opportunities, especially in the France périphérique, marginalized, isolated communities. And it's partly a feeling, a perception, because social inequalities are high or developing, and many people are afraid of future. But in fact, if we compare last 50 years, France is much, much, much richer now than 50 years ago. And there is, l'INSEE, National Statistical Institute, which calculates how many work at the minimal wage you need to buy some bread, a car, something. And you see that in 50 years, then even poor people, relatively poor people, became very much richer than before. But they don't feel that. Right. And so they're afraid of the future. And it's, of course, something very, it's a fuel for contestative blocks like NUPES or National Rally.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. The thing that is amazing to me was what Benjamin was saying, that France is actually very well off compared to what it was 50 years ago. When I look at small towns in France, we just talked about this on our last podcast with Tom Frank, who's an American writer about economics. Compared to small towns in America, small towns in France seem cleaner. They have actual economies. They have businesses that work. Small towns in America are completely destroyed. The downtowns are empty. The people are gone. The buildings are in ruins. There are trees growing through them, right? That is not what small towns in France look like. They look like they're well-maintained. It seems like there's a lot more money in rural areas than there is in the United States. So I'm surprised that the French are so upset, because I'm like, look at what happened at our place. It's a disaster.
Right, but Whitney, I think that's not accurate. I think the small towns in France are suffering, and you see them. The schools are not there. The boulangerie is not there. The only thing that's still there is the mairie. That's all that's left. I was looking up, trying to find what policies shifted about eight years ago, because something happened. I was in the south of France at that point for a month in a small town that had lost basically all its commerce. So there was a truck that came once a week with food. Right. So okay. You could go places, you could drive 30 kilometers to get food, but you couldn't, nothing in the little village existed. And they were explaining to me something about that the things were being centralized into larger community, into the larger, more urban areas, and therefore da 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 da. But I don't know the actual policies that shifted. But in all the, I've done a lot of walking around Île-de-France with a walking group. And all those villages that I'm walking through, the ones that have, okay, some have money and some are clearly prosperous. They're on a commuting line, for example. They're on the railway. But the others, or they're completely charming. For some reason, they have, you know. But what is kept, so when you do see villages that are in good shape, right, really protected and beautiful, what has happened? Many times what's happened is that people from the UK or Netherlands have moved in, right? People from out of the country have bought up property. And so it looks clean and gorgeous, but the commerce is not there. And the vitality of a tiny community's life is not there.
Benjamin, could you? Go ahead, yeah. Sugi. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I just was going to say, I certainly, as an American who has only very briefly spent time in French small towns and villages, you know, have this kind of really idealized, perhaps anachronistic, frozen in time sense of like, you know, everything, the bread there is still fresh. Whitney was like, I went to a cheesemonger. I was like, I don't know when the last time I went to a cheesemonger was.
No, in Ile-de-France, It's a righteous place in France. It's 1/3 of the national growth, you know, PIB. So Île-de-France is very rich, very rich.
Compared
it's to like this. It's like California or New York. It's very rich. So small places can be healthy, you know. You have money. If you go to Nord Pas-de-Calais or Lorraine or other places like that, mm-hmm. or my place in Normandy, which is not poor, but in some places it's not really wealthy, you know. It's not the same at all, not at all. Right. And you're right when you say there is nobody left, there is nothing. That's true. That's exactly that. But Île-de-France is not representative at all, at all. It's like if you say New York was where the states. No, of course, there is Tennessee too. It's not possible to generalize. And I guess too, that friends come, you know, rural communities, they come from very low. After the war, it was almost like the third world in some mm-hmm. rural France. So it is better now, but it's not necessarily very, very good.
I guess we can't spend the whole time talking about what towns in France are rich or not, but I'm just going to ask you, because I was in the Drôme, I was in Die, which is a pretty small town that looked like it seemed like it was in great shape. It's centre-ville.
Some still of them, but you didn't visit the projects of the north, of the east of France, old blue collar projects, mm-hmm. Abandoned, poor, with okay. many poor people from Algeria most of the time, with drug problems, you know.
Right, the banlieue of the industrial areas and the projects of major towns, even like Lyon, are very, very different. That's a whole different deal. Yeah.
So there is a clivage. Diane was right to say it's a community line question. But like in the state, in fact, it's really different from a place to another. It can change really, really. But, I think many Americans think France is socialist and so everything is the same everywhere, more or less. But it's not true. In fact, it's like, you know, you have the suburbia, prosperous. You have small towns with wine, you know, or alcohol.
Yeah, Dee had a lot of wine caves. That's a wine industry.
Yeah, and they have money, of course. And everything is okay. And you have projects. Mm-hmm. Old cities abandoned, old blue-collar neighborhoods with, you know, two or three or four generations of unemployed people, which is impossible to reintegrate in the job market because it's too long. It's been too long. Mm-hmm. And so those one, it's not the same France, but it exists. Mm-hmm. And they vote for National Rally or for Mélenchon.
I'm just going to mention François Bon, which is a French writer who I have worked with in the past, who writes about this stuff. Diane, you had something that you wanted to go on to a different topic, so I want to, and I stopped you. So now we're done with the economics. What did you want to say?
No, the small towns. Just
oh, okay.
Talking about that. But one other thing I'm thinking, as a population in a small, let's say you have a village of 800 people and the population ages, because the young people, nothing's keeping them there. They're going to go to urban areas. I mean, that's happening over the world. This is not unique to France. But and then you lose so much, right?
All right. So we're a podcast that talks about politics, but also literature. And both of you are deeply involved in the literature side of that equation. So we want to pivot there for a little bit. Diane, you live in Paris. I'm assuming you wrote most of your book of poetry, Fractal Shores, there. Is that right? Am I correct to assume that?
You are correct to assume that.
Okay.
Many of them didn't begin in France, but they were written there.
I wonder if you would read to us a couple poems, and then we're going to talk about them.
Sure. Thank you. I just want to say it's such a pleasure to see you and to meet you, Benjamin. And also, it's such an honor to be here with you on the podcast. Your invitation to speak with you has has prompted me to see the poems in a new light. I'm very aware that some of the poems have a political, I don't know, underbelly, but a political elbow, right? Something's going on in them. But I really had not seen it as sort of, I just noticed it in individual poems. And I know that I was asking myself, can I do this? Am I allowed to do this? Can I say this when I was writing? So it's a book of prose poems. Some have grown out of experiences in France, others in the High Sierras, and others grew out of images or questions. Overall, I've thought of them as located more in landscapes than in politics. But inspired by anticipating speaking with you, if you think of politics as relationships among the polis in all the nuanced muddle of our human interactions and communities, then yes, they are little conversations within and with our current political world. Certainly some more than others. The first poem I'm going to read is called Visiting Gertrude Stein in Père Lachaise, and it's about Gertrude Stein, poet, writer, is buried in Père Lachaise. She lived in France for many, many years, and she's buried in Père Lachaise, and I made a pilgrimage to her grave, and it's about that. It began with that pilgrimage, but also with a nagging recognition that had I been alive 100 years ago and able to attend her salon, I, as a woman, would have been relegated to the kitchen with Alice. And while the men, Matisse, Picasso, Hemingway, et cetera, were at Gertrude Stein's knees. And I had this line, I would have been with Alice and the herbs instead of Gertrude parsing verbs, which eventually I let go of because it didn't belong in that. But that's part of the context of this prose poem. There's an epigraph from her book, Wars I Have Seen. And there's a phrase in the poem, Trees Weep, that's also from this book, The Wars I Have Seen. And the epigraph is, which is real, what you do now or what you used to do? Visiting Gertrude Stein in Père Lachaise. Her stone is not the largest, polished gray, edges square, her name engraved. One could stand on it, one could sit. Others have placed stones upon the stone. Gravity would do as well. Bones don't expatriate from earth. But a name, among so many names, every heart once beating on its own. Trees weep, seeds scatter to the gravel path, perfect seeds, imperfect seeds, the wars we have seen. The sky is so convincing, but wars, each replaced by the one which follows. You never think it's going to be like this. You never think the thinking ends. I am sitting on a wooden bench for the view, for the veil between. I have walked to her door. I have walked away. Atoms, all quivering space.
That's fantastic. Keep going.
Thank you. And this prose poem called Only Connect started with an image of contrails in the sky and the view outside my window in Paris. The contrails at this particular moment looked like an equal sign in the sky. And at the time I was a bit under the weather dealing with what is called frozen shoulder, which is a ridiculous challenge. You end up having to do everything with the opposite hand because the shoulder actually is frozen. It has a real name and a real cause. I started thinking about weather, external atmosphere weather and internal emotional weather. And in the early versions of the prose poem, I described the pain I was in, but that wasn't the subject at all. The subject is more how one thing does and does not stand in for something else. Only connect. Above, terracotta roof tiles, contrails crisscross the sky like math symbols, mooring relation, equal to, not equal to, seeds of ice spreading as thin white veils. One condensed against another, formed in the wake of thinking, equal to, not equal to. As waves, fronts, ridges, troughs, Earth's rotation moves our view around. A woman leans out her window to water blooming lavender. A green bird is perched behind the telephone, as wind, as direction and force. We make the bed we do not want to sleep in. How much thinking clouds our thinking, the body conversing for the mind. We want to sing. We want to lift both hands to the sky. Ah, for a firmament of song. Equal to, not equal to. The telephone has no battery. The bird is painted wood. The woman is made known by pen and ink. But we ourselves are saying so. Imagine that.
I love that. Thank you so much for reading. And you were talking a little bit about, you know, thinking about your work as political or not political. And of course, you know, as a co-host of this podcast, I am required to do politics and everything. And I do. And, you know, I think in so many of your lines, I do hear that. And, you know, for example, how will we see in common if we don't take someone's part, that line? And I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about, after so many years of living in France, how you think about your work is affected by the political environment in France, where you live, where you've been living, or in the US or elsewhere.
I think that I'm in the world, right? And I'm not a sponge exactly, but I'm responding sometimes unwillingly to what's going on. And so it's with anything, you know, I don't think I'm working overtly politically. If I were, I would be writing essays, and I'm not. I'm my loyalty is to a given prose poem, is to a given text that has its own subject. Is that subject, you know? But I can't escape it either. So in the poem that you're in the prose poem you're referring to, the one that where the flying colors. I was very aware of what I was doing there. Red and blue, the colors, red and blue were, and I couldn't escape it. I didn't exactly want to go in that direction, but I couldn't. That's what the poem was doing, and so it had, you know, it has a life of its own. And my question to myself was, is this decorative? Is this naive? Can I ask this question? Can I be so apparent in asking that? The poem about ISIS, for example, another one which is visiting the statue in Herbert Hoover's birthplace outside of Iowa City. And there's a statue of ISIS. And I was working on this one for years. And until ISIS, that word was taken over by the, you know, as a became a word that was politicized and dangerous and no longer just the name of a goddess, right? But until that happened, I didn't have the poem. So sometimes I can't escape it. But your question, has France, yes, of course it has. just as the U.S. has, you know, I'm a person of my time and place.
Benjamin, you're an editor at Lazy Edition Gallmeister, as we said before. You have your own imprint, Totem, which you began in 2010, which specializes in American nature writing. Gallmeister in general specializes in American literature in translation, you know, translated into French, which shows the interest that the French take in American writing and culture, which is very real, and I appreciate. How has that interest been affected by recent political developments in America, like Trump's election, for instance, or the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which I saw signs on the street out here in Lyon about that, saying, honte aux États-Unis, right? Or do politics not matter when it comes to literary taste? And that doesn't affect whether people want to read about Thoreau or not.
Ah, So that's true. We began with natural writing, and we still publish this kind of literature. But now we understand it's a war American literature. Of course, we're interested in American politics, of course, because it's a major country of the West, because we are all allied countries, because we are a bit jealous, because this kind of thing. No, but you know, it's obvious. I guess 90 or 95% of our authors don't support Republicans. And most of French people liked Obama much more than Trump. I don't take a big risk in saying that.
Yeah.
But I don't think literature should have a political line. I mean, I won't choose a text because the author has a political argumentation that I like, you see. So in France, I guess everybody is interested in what happens in America because we think it's perhaps what could happen in 10 years here. Because we adore to say, haha, the Americans are wrong. And we adore to say, haha, the Americans are right. And, you know, it's like an old couple, an old relationship. But the States are more powerful than France. So, you know, we listen more than we say. But in fact, it's been two centuries that American and French culture are tied, are bound. Mm-hmm. It was true in the time of James Fenimore Cooper, and it's true now. It was true in the 20th century with the musicians, you know, mm-hmm. African American jazzmen or writers. It was true, and French writers have been, and cineasts and have been fascinated, and musicians, of course, have been fascinated by the folk culture, the American culture, and especially the folk culture. We love, we like, you know, Hollywood, we like pulp, we like westerns. It's not our story. We didn't conquer the West, and so we are bound to the States, whatever we think about the States. That's a fact of life. That's all. So, of course, European, French, and European prefer Democrats and Obama, and the legend. You know, in France, it was Jesus Christ. It was an honest president, but perhaps not the Messiah. Perhaps not. So Reagan is not popular, and Obama is. That's a fact. So we can think whatever we like about that. It's a fact. But anyway, French people and European people, I think, are fascinated by the American culture because it's new, it's young, it's dynamic, it's strong, it's interesting. It's the new frontier of what we don't know, the artificial intelligence, perhaps, after the space, after the moon. God, the moon. You know, it's a fascination. Most of the French people I know who say, I don't like the States, they go to Disney, to Marvel, to American literature, to pulp fiction. They love that.
I have the man who lives below me in this apartment comes up. This is the second time we've lived in this apartment, and he's done it both times we've lived here. My son plays baseball in the living room, and he gets very angry and comes up and yells at us for making too much noise. But then all day long, he plays jazz music and American rock and roll on his. He has a giant record collection that he showed us that's all American music. I just want you to know, Benjamin, I'm sorry. Americans love French culture as well and are equally fascinated by it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Tant mieux.
I was going to say, yeah, but this is all mutual.
I think most of European, Western European, consider America, which they don't necessarily know very well, in fact. And they consider America like a brand new Europe, not so old, not so, weak, not so, it's like us, but in better. But of course, it's a cliche. Of course, it's a cliche. Huh? I agree with that. But I think there is some psychoanalytical thing like that, you know. America, it's like us, but in better.
And also so much worse. But yes, our mutual admiration and fascination. I think that, you know, one thing you can see so frequently, and I remember in college taking a class that was basically sort of about Americans abroad and like seeing all of these like these landscapes and stuff, these Europe, like the trope of the American abroad, you know, taking a grand tour, and kind of seeing all of that space represented in American literature. And Diane, your poems mention France and French landmarks. You've already mentioned Père Lachaise, and there are other landmarks in your work as well quite frequently. And I wonder if we could end this episode and this conversation about our mutual interests with a reading from a poem set on the Seine.
Sure. I like thinking of it in that context. Thank you for that. It's a prose poem called On Balance, Denis Jocelyn Crossing the Seine. So on the same day that we made this pilgrimage to Père Lachaise for Gertrude Stein, to see Gertrude Stein's grave, it was the Paris Marathon. And after dodging hundreds of runners crossing back over the river, we walked back across the Pont Charles de Gaulle, and where we discovered a man who was preparing to cross the Seine on a high wire, and Denis Jocelyn. So it turns out there was a lot of preparation before he was allowed. He was the first person who was allowed to do this, and it was quite glorious to watch. On balance, Denis Jocelyn crossing the Seine. If we are what we leave behind, then what is the sky with its shifting horizons, the river bisecting land, the ligature of wind-blown trees? Even in a raspberry silk blouson, a man is but the wind's apostrophe, so far as I can see from the deck of a white péniche. I am looking up with aperitif and wonder, such a spectacle of trust each step he takes, above the river, below the sky, such concatenation each one by one. Through my binoculars he smiles, his gray hair curls, the silk blouson is not tucked in. One must be authorized to cross above the Seine, the high steel wire made familiar, the weighted black pole. He is not walking on air, nor am I, and yet it is my birthday. I am crossing from you must be kidding to what if. He kneels. I hold my breath. He stretches out. He wraps a scarf across his eyes. If, shifting now and then.
Thank you very much. And thanks to both of you. We encourage our listeners to go out and pick up a copy of Diane Louise's Fractal Shores. And if you are interested in great French translations of American writing, please visit Benjamin's Totem and Gallmeister in general.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!